This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Voters in six U.S. states cast their ballots for former Vice President Joe Biden and U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders in the race for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. Biden won several states big over Sanders. Voters also casting ballots in the states of Idaho and Washington, North Dakota, holding Democratic caucuses. U.S. health officials say more and more public and private laboratories are now able to test for the coronavirus. AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
Clusters of coronavirus cases are being reported on both coasts of the United States, with 70 cases now connected to a biotech conference in Boston, leading Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker to declare a state of emergency. In hard-hit Washington state, 10 nursing homes are reporting infections. Washington Governor Jay Inslee.
In 7 or 8 weeks, there could be 64,000 people infected in the state of Washington if we don't somehow slow down this epidemic.
On the campaign trail, Democratic presidential candidates Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders called off rallies scheduled in Cleveland Tuesday night.
The last thing we will ever want to do is put anybody in danger.
I'm Mike Gracia.
Members of President Trump's coronavirus task force held a news conference Tuesday with updates on the spread of the disease and what Americans should do to cope. While the number of new cases in China has slowed, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said coronavirus continues to be a problem globally.
The cases continue to increase globally. We're paying particular attention to the cases in Europe, in Italy, and France, in which we're starting to see that up. At the same time as the relative number of new cases come down from China, what we're seeing in Europe is that Europe is in that upslope.
A question by reporters, U.S. President Trump said he has not been tested for the virus. This is VOA News. Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani has issued a decree setting in motion the release of thousands of Taliban prisoners as the U.S. military begins a troop drawdown in the country. The U.S.-Taliban agreement sealed in Qatar 10 days ago requires all American and coalition forces to leave the country in the next 14 months. The agreement is subject to insurgent counterterrorism assurances and commitments the Taliban would seek a political reconciliation with other Afghan stakeholders. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is deploring the violent escalating attacks against political opponents of the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Michelle Bachelet presented an oral update on the situation there to the UN Human Rights Council Tuesday. Lisa Schleim reports for VOA from Geneva.
Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says the human rights situation in Venezuela has worsened since she last reported on conditions in that country in December. She speaks through an interpreter.
My office has also documented aggressions against members of the political opposition, protesters, and journalists. And the security forces did not act to prevent such aggressions. We have also registered cases of seizures by political parties and NGOs. These aggressions are usually accompanied by a rhetoric that stigmatizes, exposes, and discredits the victims and justifies violence.
Bachelet, a former president of Chile, says she's also concerned about pending legislation to sanction human rights organizations that receive funding from abroad. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And Venezuela's ambassador to the UN in Geneva criticized the High Commissioner's presentation as lacking balance, but he does note that the necessity of maintaining a dialogue with her office and says his country welcomes its technical assistance. As thousands of migrants continue to mass on the Turkey-Greece border, there have been few signs of a breakthrough in emergency talks between Turkey and the European Union. Five EU member states, Germany, Finland, France, Luxembourg, and Portugal, agreed to take in unaccompanied migrant children who are stuck in Greece through numbers, although the numbers are unclear. Ankara encouraged migrants to head to the Greek border last week, accusing the EU of failing to keep the promises it made in a 2016 deal struck at the height of the European refugee crisis. Turkey is hosting around 4 million migrants. Many of them are escaping the war in Syria. However, critics say most of those trying to cross into Greece are not from Syria and accuse Turkey of weaponizing migrants to blackmail Europe. More at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A war of words is getting fiercer in Malawi as the main opposition leader calls President Mutharika a temporary tenant at State House.
The Reverend ought to understand that we are in a democracy in Malawi, and the President does not give orders to the police to arrest or release people. He seems to be living the hangover of his bad leadership in the last 1 year.
The president of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People of Nigeria will discuss the status of the struggle. Internally displaced persons of Sudan's Darfur region demand a semi-autonomous government. Cameroon journalists call for help after losing their jobs because of war. And Guinea's opposition leaders are going to the ECOWAS Court of Justice today, Wednesday.
One of the purposes of Abuja is to have the rights of the Guinean people protected, because today we don't have any protection from the Guinean government. We are living the state of terror.
Fayemi Limuno is a member of the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution in Guinea and will examine the impact of the coronavirus on Senegal's oil importing economy. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A war of words is getting fiercer in Malawi as main opposition leader Lazarus Chakwera of the Malawi Congress Party calls President Peter Mutharika a temporary tenant at State House. Chakwera has given President Mutharika 48 hours to release the leaders of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition. Chakwera has also called for a nationwide peaceful demonstration tomorrow, Thursday, to demand electoral reforms and for President Mutarika's failure to uphold the rule of law. But Mgemin Kalilani, spokesperson for President Mutharika, says Mr. Chakwera is a bitter person after losing two elections to President Mutharika. Kalilani says Malawi is a democracy and President Mutharika does not give orders to the police to arrest or release people who had been arrested.
He's a very bitter person. You know, he has lost election to Professor Peter Mutharika twice. This is his second attempt at the president. So he's a bitter man. We understand his bitterness, but unfortunately he decides to express his bitterness in a manner that is not expected of a person like him.
Mr. Chakwera has given President Mutharika 48 hours to release the leaders of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition. And the 48 hours conclude tomorrow, Thursday.
In the first place, I'm calling him a masquerade because he doesn't have power whatsoever he to order the president around. Suffice to say, the Reverend ought to understand that we are in a democracy in Malawi, and the president does not give orders to the police to arrest or release people. He seems to be living the hangover of his party's dictatorship in the last 31 years, in which the president, the dictator that we had, would order around arrest or release of people at his will. Malawi doesn't run that way this time around. In a democracy, the police works independently. The police has suspects in the Constitution of the Republic of Malawi. When the police have arrested suspects, they are given 48 hours within which they have to conclude their investigation. If not, then the suspects will be released on bail upon application to court. And should the police wish to keep the suspects longer than 48 hours, then they will have to go to court and justify the same.
There is a nationwide protest called for Thursday to demand what Mr. Chakwera calls electoral reforms and also for the failure of President Mutharika to uphold the rule of law. I'm assuming he's referring to the Constitutional Court's ruling.
Well, if you have been following what has been happening in Malawi, there's been a flood. Comprising of HRDC, which unfortunately are officially called the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, but it's a common fact what they have been doing is actually unleashing terror for Malawians, causing political violence, and they have been doing this on behalf of the Malawi Congress Party. Now, the two HRDC leaders have been apprehended by the police for openly mobilizing people to go and storm the state residences. And now, because the cover is blown, that's why you have residents that are coming up in the open to take up the fight himself, because he has been using the HRDC as a front. He's bitter after the loss and probably doesn't want to face Professor David Mutharika in another election. That's why he's behaving the way he is. So, yes, he's talking about nationwide demonstrations. Fine, let them do that. Let's see if they have the capacity to do that.
Some people are saying that perhaps President Mutharika is trying to play a delay tactic here. If he does not implement the ruling of the Constitutional Court, that allows the current Election Commission to stay on, because the court ruling calls for this commission to be dissolved and reorganized.
I'll go back to how I started. Malawi is a constitutional democracy. Whatsoever happens has to happen within that constitutional framework. The Constitution of the Republic of Malawi gives the president 21 working days within which the president will have to make a decision whether he is assenting to the bills passed or not. Those 21 days have not elapsed. How does that amount to failure to comply with the court order?
Thank you very much, my brother.
Thank you so much.
Gaming Kalilani is the spokesperson for Malawian President Peter Mutharika. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. In Guinea, leaders of the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution, the FNDC, are going to Nigeria today, Wednesday, for tomorrow's first hearing of a lawsuit they filed in the Community Court of Justice of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, to protect the Constitution and the people of Guinea. The group has been holding nationwide protests against a controversial constitutional referendum and parliamentary elections that were scheduled for March the 1st. The opposition says 81-year-old President Alpha Conde wants to use the referendum to stay in power. Mr. Conde was forced to postpone the referendum and parliamentary vote. Fayami Limuno, a member of the FNDC, says Guinean courts are controlled by President Conde.
Today in Guinea, we have a one-man show. The president has all the powers. He controls the judiciary, the parliamentary, the executive. Everything is in his hand. So every time the opposition, FNDC, make a lawsuit at the court of Guinea, that body considers himself as being incompetent to decide. So we took the fight to the judicial court of ECOWAS, and that's why many leaders of FNDC, including myself, will be heading to Abuja this Wednesday.
First of all, when we say that the opposition, you made some headways, because through your protest, President Alpha Conde was able to delay or postpone the controversial referendum and the parliamentary election. So what is the purpose of going to the ECOWAS court?
One of the purposes of going to Abuja is to have the right of the Guinean people protected, because today we don't have any protection from the Guinean government. We are living the state of terror here in Guinea. That's one purpose. The second purpose is to have the constitution of Guinea protected. We need to look into the protocols at the level of a government to have the Guinean constitution and the Guinean laws protected. Remember, Guinea is no longer living as a normal state. The president, the government, and all their followers are not abiding by the constitution and by the law. They are abiding by their own will. So since we are not living on another planet, we have ratified some protocols at a global level, at the African Union level, and the United Nations level. We have to look into how we can get the rights of Guinean people protected at those levels.
So what would be the most logical and acceptable solution from the ECOWAS court? What would you like for the court to do?
Since the Constitutional Court of Guinea considers itself as incompetent for any issue we bring, I think that as a member of the ECOWAS community, we have the provision that will put some constraints on the president of Guinea, his government, to abide by the law. That referendum, they are unconstitutional, illegal, and somebody has to jump in and to stop the process.
Fayami Limuno is a member of the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution in Guinea. He was speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. Today is Wednesday, March 11th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. The president of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, MOSAP, of Nigeria, says very little has happened to the plight of the Ogoni people since the murder of their leader, Ken Saro-Wiwa. Saro-Wiwa, a human rights activist and environmentalist, was hanged on November 10, 1995, along with eight others during the regime of then military leader Sani Abacha. They had led protests against the destruction of Ogoni land from leaking oil pipelines owned by Shell Oil, as well as the unfair distribution of the Ogoni region's oil wealth. I caught up with the MOSAP president Fegalo Nsukke in Washington, D.C., during a meeting of the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization of the World.
Basically, we are highlighting the plight of the Ogoni people and the need for us to actually resolve these issues amicably. We've brought to the meetings we had today the issue of the 40 Ogoni cleanup, where we have about $360 million spent in the process, yet the Ogoni people still do not have water, yet the Ogoni people still drink water that is 900 times contaminated with benzene, above the standards that are acceptable. We've also brought the issue of the marginalization, the issue of the discrimination against the Ogoni people, and we're trying to see how we can get the key parties to get involved with the process of resolving this issue for us.
Your president, Ken Saro-Wiwa, and the others, they died because of the pollution and everything that's happening in Ogoni land.
Yeah.
So you are telling me that years after that, nothing much has happened?
No, not much has happened. Unfortunately, that's part of the agitation of the Ogoni people today. One of the fundamental demands that we make today is that the nine Ogonis that were hanged in 1995 should be exonerated because they've been established to be innocent. And we are here to say that not much has changed in Ogoni since the murder of Ken Saro-Wiwa and the others. But we want to see this issue being discussed and this issue being resolved amicably.
The government of President Muhammadu Buhari, is he giving you, the Ogoni people, a listening ear in terms of your plight?
Unfortunately, the discrimination against the Ogoni people continues, and we haven't seen much done in respect of resolving that, because they've used laws to oppress the Ogoni people, to take away the Ogoni resources, leaving nothing for us. And so we've not seen much done in that respect, and that is why we are actually returning back to the international campaign to put pressure on Nigeria to address the issues of discrimination against the Ogoni people, to resolve much of what we have seen as violations of our rights.
What is the understanding now between the Ogoni people and Shell Oil?
There isn't any understanding at the moment. We expected Nigeria to have held Shell responsible for the wrongdoings in Nigeria. We haven't seen that. As a people, as a community, we are willing to engage to resolve these issues. But we do hope that speaking together, sitting down to talk together, we can make peace and we can make progress.
Sometimes I hear that there is this a split. Sometimes the leadership of the Ogoni people does not seem to come eye to eye with the Ogoni people. That sometimes some of you in leadership are not doing the right thing. Sometimes you are bought by either the government. What is happening? Are you really representing the people?
The reality is that at some point we had government and Shell agents infiltrating the leadership of MOSAP, but that's been resolved now.
Mr. President, thank you very much again. We're so happy to have you on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you very much.
Fegalo Nsukke is the president of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People of Nigeria. He was speaking with us in Washington, D.C. Dozens of reporters in Cameroon are calling for help after losing their jobs and, in some cases, their homes because of the ongoing war between separatist forces and the government. The reporters say they are constantly attacked or kidnapped for refusing to be propaganda tools for one side or the other. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
30 Cameroonian journalists, most of them women, from the volatile northwest region, have gathered in the capital city, Yaoundé, to discuss the difficulties of reporting from Cameroon's crisis zone. Komi Musa, coordinator of Sister Speak 237, an NGO that convened the meeting, says she invited reporters because they need help to continue practicing their profession.
They don't have the kind of editorial support they need to tell good stories. We have a space where we provide this kind of support, and we also help them with sourcing for grants. Occasionally, we've helped with maybe transportation to go to an area and get the story that really needs to be told.
Musa says the reporters are victims of brutality and violence, and most of them are now poor because they are either out of job or can no longer work in an environment which is increasingly hostile. It's not just female journalists who are experiencing problems. Gilles Yumo of the Guardian Post newspaper says in February, his equipment was seized by armed men. He says he cannot even apply for a job because his academic certificates were seized.
I've had several calls of threat, intimidation from separatist fighters, because it's in such a way that nobody wants to see you report what is not in their favor. So when they got my documents, what they did was collected the documents and told me that they are going to get rid of them by burning.
Freelance journalist Mary Ngwa says she moved from Bamenda to Yaoundé due to threats from separatists.
I reported on the soldiers. That's when I received the big threat of my life. I started receiving phone calls. The guys were asking me, why didn't you report about the other people that were killed? Why did you report only about the military?
Since the separatist crisis started in 2017, journalists have complained of abuses by both the government and separatists fighting for the independence of the English-speaking areas from the majority French-speaking state. More than two dozen said they have been arrested or threatened. Jude Viban, president of the Cameroon Association of English-Speaking Journalists, says the military and separatists should know that reporters are not propaganda tools.
We denounce each time that a journalist is attacked. And then equally, what we're trying to do is to provide some material like bulletproof jackets to help the journalists work in those areas. We're opening a lot of discussions for government forces to really understand that journalists are not in any way the enemy, but they are just doing their job.
The Cameroon government insists that it does not exert pressure on reporters, and the military has always said they do not harass reporters. Separatist groups, meanwhile, have said they will not allow anyone to stand in their path toward self-determination. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
About 50 internally displaced persons, or IDPs, living in camps north, west, and south Darfur say they want a semi-autonomous government. The IDPs, who were transported to Juba to speak to mediators of peace talks between armed groups and Sudanese government officials, say their own leaders will be able to solve problems in the area. Dean Mangot has more from Juba.
Darfur IDP representative Hashim Ali, who is a delegate at the peace talks, says his group presented a proposal to the delegates stating their desire to have a semi-autonomous government in Darfur. Ali says the people of Darfur believe a semi-autonomous region is best suited to address the many challenges unique to the area.
There is guns in the hand of the militia, and there is people whom they, up to now, they are not letting people doing much kind of things. So killing women, raping, many kind of issues it is still, but we hope to be far those obstacles. We hope that this government should solve such problems, and we, at last, we need peace.
40-year-old IDP Muna Ahmed, who has worked as a teacher in North Darfur State IDP camp for nearly 20 years, says she traveled to Juba to convince Sudanese leaders it's time for a leadership change in Darfur. Speaking in Arabic, Ahmed says IDPs also want the government to compensate families for everything they lost during the civil war.
For example, some families lost many members. Some lost like 17, 16, 10, and 15. We want compensation for individuals and for groups. This compensation, if it is money, it will be at least $155,000 for all IDPs.
Muna says IDPs want to return to their home villages once a peace deal is signed, but in the meantime, she says the government must ensure soldiers occupying civilians' homes are evacuated. Safa Al-Adil, a member of the Darfur Women's IDPs Forum, says Sudanese women want a voice at the talks.
We want to remind you about the women in Western Darfur and in an IDP camp called Green Tea or Rhino. There are some human rights abuses. The abuses make some women to leave the camp and go to their own places. This issue should make the negotiators to speed up the peace talks, so with the peace we can protect our women.
For VOA News, I am Ding Makot in Juba.
While the coronavirus outbreak is wreaking havoc on stock markets worldwide, its effect on African markets varies. Ondongo Osila, an economist with the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation in Dakar, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the impact on Senegal's oil importing economy.
One effect which is important is the decline of oil prices. Now they have reached a low level. And we know that the impact will depend on countries. Those who produce and export oil, like Nigeria, will suffer from it. There is the possibility, for example, that the Nigerian currency, the Naira, will be devalued owing to the fact that the oil prices are depressed. But for other countries, like, for example, mine, Senegal will be producing oil in 2 years. But for now, we are importing crude oil. So this is good news for us because, as we are importing net oil, that means that our oil import bills will go down. So it's good news for the government of Senegal because the IMF was asking for austerity measures and they did not anticipate that the oil price would decline.
Has it had any impact on developments going on in Senegal of the offshore reserves of natural gas and oil?
For now, there have not been public discussions about that. If the trends continue, but we cannot be sure if the trends will continue, that would be, not a good news for Senegal, because if Senegal starts to exploit oil and gas and the prices are low, it will not be good for the government.
A lot of, market vendors in places like Senegal sell goods imported from China, which perhaps provide them with a small living, but also compete with locally made goods, for example, shoes. Has there been any impact in that area at all yet?
I'm not sure. It could have some impact, but when we discuss with people in the import-export business, many of them are in a difficult situation because China is a cheap source for supplying imported goods in Senegal. And many merchants currently, they could do nothing. They could not spend, they could not do business because they ordered things in China. And they have not received what they ordered in China.
That was Ondongo Osila, an economist with the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. He was speaking with Ricky Stryak from Senegal's capital, Dakar. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A war of words is getting fiercer in Malawi as main opposition leader Lazarus Chakwera of the Malawi Congress Party calls President Arthur Peter Mutharika a temporary tenant at State House. Chakwera has given President Mutharika 48 hours to release the leaders of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, but Ngemi Kalilani, the spokesperson for President Mutharika, says Malawi is a democracy and President Mutharika does not give orders to the police to arrest or release people who had been arrested. And Guinea, leaders of the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution are going to Nigeria today, Wednesday, for tomorrow's first hearing of a lawsuit they filed in the Community Court of Justice of the Economic Community of West African States. That is it for this Wednesday, March 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Botti in Washington.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the United Nations says climate change is the defining issue of our time. Its impact is already being felt in Africa, affecting food production and political stability. The effects of climate change on the continent, on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
A wonderful ride with a ray of sunshine and a pinch of love awaits you. We are coming to take you on a magical journey where things are much more alive and happening. Join us on March 13th to hear the greatest Disney hits ever. So don't forget to tune in only on Water Crossings, The Voice of America.